You're listening to On Del Mar, and today we're speaking with forest ecologist Joan Maloof. We met up with her in a forest that's on public land, right near her house in Quantico, Maryland.
So what do you think?
I think it's gorgeous. It's open. How old growth is this?
Well, this is really not old growth at all. And when I first started coming out here, I thought, it's an average Eastern Shore forest. It's got a lot of loblolly pines. They're the biggest trees in here because they were the first ones to start after it was cleared. This probably was an agricultural field at one time. Guessing it was abandoned about the time of the Depression when so many people left the area and abandoned their fields. But then it's started growing back naturally with the species that are around here. And so that would be the pine first, and then you'd have cherries and dogwoods and hollies and maples, all kinds of oaks, hickories. And it was over the years that I started realizing that this forest, although it's not that old, was special because it was a native forest. It's the mixed species that were here. It's not a pine plantation.
The pine plantations are not natural?
Well, pine will naturally come in when you clear an area around here, but to be kept in just pine, you know, to maybe what they do now to keep the pine is they'll spray if other species start to come in, the maples and the sweet gums. And what I saw happening was all these forests that are native mixed forests like this were being clear cut, then controlled pine regrowth, and that pine can only be left in place for like 40 years and they cut it and start all over again. So once a forest was being converted to pine, it was kept in pine. It never was allowed to get to be the mixed forest that we see here again.
It's done on purpose because people harvest it. Yeah. They want the pine.
So in the area, I saw so many of the private forests being cut about this age and converted to pine plantation. And when the county acquired this land with program open space money, and this became public land, and the plan was to do the same thing to this land, I thought, no way. This is a park. This should have this beautiful forest, not just for the people, but for all the species that live here that depend on the mixed forest.
And what species are you talking about that depend on these mixed forests that are natural growths?
Well, what we're looking at right now, besides the loblolly pine, are red maples and sweet gum. There's beech in here. There's holly. There's a lot of red oak. There's some white oak. More that I can't think of just at the moment standing here, but we'll come across. There's a little baby oak tree there. So, as a forest ecologist, when I look at this forest, I think it's not even middle age yet. What's going to happen here eventually is these pines can easily grow for another 100 years. And then as we lose them, we won't have new pines starting up in the understory because the little baby pines like the sun. We'll have other trees growing up in the understory, such as the oaks and the beech trees. And it will eventually become less of a pine forest and more of a deciduous forest, which are the native forests around here.
Okay, the deciduous forests are the native forests.
Yeah. Pines will always be a part of it, but they won't always be the dominant in the landscape.
Right. You know, it's very funny you say that, because I always associated pine forests as a kid being here, mm-hmm. in the Eastern Shores as a civil rights worker.
Oh.
I always associate the pine forest with segregation and segregationists. Just
wow. So.
And I never knew they weren't natural.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fits. What do you have in your hand there?
That's a willow oak.
That's a willow oak.
Yeah, that was one I forgot to mention. So as I kept coming out here, every time I came out, it became more special to me because I realized how in danger it was of being converted to just a 100% pine forest that would be cleared over and over again. And I kept wondering how I could protect it because any day the trucks could be here. You know, I could wake up in the morning and I could hear the grinding and the crunching that you hear with the logging. And it's perfectly legal. And it's the normal thing that gets done around here. But I didn't think it was the right thing for the public land that was going to be a park someday. And this was just kind of going over my mind. What could I do? What could I do? And I actually brought Tom Horton out here. Uh-huh. With a couple other people one time, and he wrote a wonderful article that was back in 1997 pointing out what a mistake it would be to log this beautiful forest that was going to be part of a park and turn it into a pine plantation. So that saved us a few years.
Uh-huh.
That was the power of journalism. You know, that was wonderful. But it's still just that one article, as the years went by, I was still nervous. Yeah. And it was in 2001, October 2001. So a month after the towers came down, a speaker came to the university talking about Buddhism and nature. And he told this story about how these Buddhist monks saved these old-growth trees by ordaining the trees as monks and wrapping saffron robes around the trees. So no logger in that country, this is Thailand, would dare to kill a monk so they would not cut down these trees that were monks. And I thought, well, that might not work here. But maybe something like that. And I was sitting in that lecture thinking, what do we honor in our culture? What do people respect that they would not want to, you know, kill a representation of, say? Or what could we equate these trees with that would be respected in our culture? And that's when it came to me that the victims of September 11th, they were being so honored in our culture then, and couldn't we equate perhaps the killing of these trees, I thought unnecessarily, with the horrible killings that took place that day. And the next day I went online to try to find the names of the victims. We kept hearing about these numbers, you know, how many thousands there were, but the actual names. And people, of course, had been documenting the names, and I told them my idea, and they were so wonderful to share the names with me. They thought it was a great idea, too. And so I got the list of names, almost 3,000 names, and I talked to other volunteers, other people about the idea. They wanted to be part of it. They loved the idea. So then I ordered tags, I ordered yarn, and we started making tags, each tag with the name and the age of one of the people that died on September 11th.
And what did you tag, the oak trees?
So after we made all the tags, we came in here and we just had these bags full of tags and we just started randomly pulling tags and just, we'd put the tag on a red piece of yarn, tie the yarn loosely around the tree, and so all kinds of trees, young trees, old trees, beech trees, pine trees, oak trees, holly trees, were all tagged. And that, even though there were so many tags, that wasn't every single tree in here, because there's many more thousands of trees in here than there were victims. But when you walked in here then, you would see all these shiny metal tags with the names and red ribbons on all these trees. And
it took.
It was the September 11th Memorial Forest.
And that's what this is now.
And in my mind, it still is. Although, the story continues. Because year after year then, I thought, I felt like it was protected somehow. Not only, perhaps you'd say spiritually, but also protected from the people that might not want to mess with a September 11th Memorial Forest. And the response was good. I think only one or two people out of all the hundreds I ever talked to thought that it was maybe inappropriate. Most people thought that it was a great way to honor the victims and a great way to save a forest at the same time. But as I came out here more and more frequently checking on the tags over the years, I noticed the yarn was getting a little bit tighter and tighter around the trees because the trees were growing in diameter. I always assumed that this yarn would last out here a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then it would decompose. Well, it had been 4 years. The yarn didn't decompose, and it was getting, on some trees, a little snug. And you don't want to have anything
eating into the tree.
Tight about a tree, right.
Right.
Because that could kill the tree. And I thought, I don't want to be the one responsible for killing all these trees. What should I do? So I started coming out here and removing all the tags that I could find. So now we stand here, and it's still the September 11th Memorial Forest, but you don't see any string or any tags. Hopefully, occasionally you'll find one or two somewhere off in a little corner left behind. But I have all the tags that were in here still in a giant bag. I'm not sure what I want to do with them.
So this still remains the 9/11 forest?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that official or unofficial?
A little bit of both. It was very interesting. So many people started planting trees in honor and in memory of the victims. All over the country, there are 9/11 memorial forests, but they're almost all planted trees. They're not trees that were saved and prevented from being cut. And the federal government then created a tracking website where they listed all the September 11th memorial forests. And this forest is listed on their website as a September 11th Memorial Forest.
So it's unofficially protected.
Yes.
Yes.
It's not protected.
Right. It's not protected.
It's still the September 11th Memorial Forest, but it still could be logged any day. It's not officially protected in any way. It belongs to Wicomico County, and their plans have always been to log it someday. So I don't know that that's changed at all. I don't think it has.
So are there conversations about making this officially protected and not logged?
We have not had any direct conversations with them about that. Part of the problem is the value of the timber. Every year that we put off the logging of the timber, whether it's these articles or making it a September 11th memorial forest, it gets more and more valuable.
Right. So what is the discussion about the value of this forest? Not an old growth forest, but a forest that is now becoming a natural forest in terms of the species that's growing in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the value of this forest to the other species, of course, well, there's, you know, what we're standing under is this beautiful beech tree. That's why I stopped here, because it's young. But the beech don't come in until the forest has some nice age on it. And so as this forest is getting older, now we have the beech trees come in. if this forest gets clear cut for the pines, we're not going to have any more beech here ever again. And that's just one species. I also noticed right over here in the sunlight, now the sun has shifted. Oh, here it is. A beautiful little orchid. This is a wild orchid, Listeria australis. And that orchid probably won't survive through the logging equipment that would come in here. Then we hear the birds. Nice timing. And the squirrels. I've seen raccoons sleeping up in trees here. There's fox, box turtles, mosquitoes. Yes. So there's those species. But then if we just think of the value to humans, too, beyond the fiber in the wood, how about this beautiful clean air?
Yes.
And the groundwater that's being filtered and the nutrients taken up through this forest that are not going into the Chesapeake Bay then. The forest is the number one best way to clean the bay. And then just the beauty of nature itself and how it makes us feel to be in a forest like this.
Joe Weingrad, you know Jerry Weingrad, yeah. A former state senator, also likes nuclear power. He argues that we should let the old natural forest take over and not cut one down if we want to save the bay and replenish our world.
Well, I can't disagree with him, although I would have to say that it's really not practical right now. I would take a less extreme view, but just as controversial, and that's like, how about let's not cut the public forests? It's only 10% of the forests in Maryland are public forests. Let's start there. Let's say, okay, if you are a landowner and, you know, you want to make money from your pine trees, that's fine. But this forest is public forest. It belongs to all of us. And these are the ones we won't cut. These are the ones that'll clean the water, that'll clean the air, that'll give families a place to go, give the other species a place to live. I don't hear anybody really much
saying that.
Saying that, yeah. Someday.
And when you have these forests that are not cut, that are left going back, mm-hmm. how do the species who naturally live here come back? How does that happen? In other words, these are planned pine forests.
Right.
But now we're looking at...
Well, that's a good question because... And I did some research summer before last for the Nature Conservancy, because the Nature Conservancy has 10,000 acres on the eastern shore here in the Nasawango Preserve. A lot of it is lowland near the Nasawango Creek, and there's beautiful bald cypress trees. But they wanted to expand their preserve, and they had the ability to purchase some land that was higher and drier, and it was in pine plantation, like most of our forests.
Right.
So they took advantage of the opportunity to acquire it, but now the Nature Conservancy owns pine plantation. And they would like to restore that to what the native forests are here, but what to do? And part of my research was looking at those forests and seeing what may have been the natural species there and making some suggestions. And what I discovered, which was good news to me, was that all of those species still exist, but as what the foresters would consider weeds in the forest. So
the natural species are the weeds.
Yeah. For instance, black gum trees would be coming up, and the oak trees would be coming up, and the hickory trees would come up, and these, not really what you want if you're just managing your forest for pure pine, mm-hmm. because that's what has the most value here. But as an ecologist, that was good news to me because it shows that if we then give them a chance to take over, that they're already here. We don't have to replant those species. They're still seed in our soil and seeds nearby, which is nice. But if we keep logging this place and controlling it as a pine plantation for another few hundred years, who knows? We may be losing species that then aren't getting old enough to produce seeds and restore the forest naturally.
Is there room for both?
Oh,
yes. The natural, the planned pine forests and the old growth?
Yes.
The natural growth, I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I talk about leaving an area alone and not logging it, sometimes other folks get nervous. They think, oh, well, you know, we've got to log for the money, and it's a great industry here. It is. It's the number two industry on the shore after the chickens, and it's a nice, clean industry. I mean, look at this air that we're under. You know, this is so wonderful. So I would not take away forestry as an economic engine on the shore. But my point is that not every single forest should be part of that. The pine plantations as crops, fine. Maybe even 90%. But that other 10%, we should say, this is not going to be logged. These are the public forests. These are the ones that should be allowed to get older.
So yeah, there's this difference now between this natural forests and the old growth, of which there are very few left.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, this is a natural forest, but it's not an old growth forest. This forest could recover and eventually someday become an old growth forest, but that would take maybe 200 to 300 years.
Uh-huh.
We would have to leave it alone long enough for the young beech that we saw and the young oaks to reach their maximum age, die of natural causes, fall over, have this big dead logs on the soil floor that then are nurses for other trees to start up, and they would have to reach the end of their life cycle and fall naturally and die and build the soil, and then eventually we'd have an old growth forest here again like we used to have. But that's going to take a while. So I like to think of places like this as future old growth forests, because we've got to start somewhere. And this forest now is over 80 years old. And if we were to cut this again and then say, okay, now we'll make it a natural forest.
Another 300 years.
Yeah. We'd be that much further back. So a lot of what I have in mind is for people that aren't even here on the planet right now.
Right.
That are going to be here in the future, that will be grateful to us.
Generations to come.
Yes.
Seven generations from now, as some would say.
I'm benefiting from what people in the past have done, because I've journeyed to these old growth forests in the East that are marvelous. They're incredible, diverse places. And they're only there because people that are gone now saved those so that I could see them. So I feel like it's my job to do that going forward. I'm stopping here because of these petals. I guess these are dogwood.
These are dogwood.
Yeah, dogwood. I mean the white petals here.
Oh, those,
on the ground.
Yes, yes.
So there's dogwood trees. And then this is a water oak, another species of oak.
So tell me about what brought you to this.
So when you were small, did you ever play in the woods?
Always. We had a woods on the golf courses near us.
Uh-huh.
And there were still woods around our house. So we used to play in those woods all the time, mm-hmm. living there.
And did you ever find yourself just captivated by a particular scene or a plant,
yeah.
and just feeling the mystery in it? I remember feeling that way as a child, too. And then as I got older and I had to pick a career path, I realized how much I love being outdoors and how much I love being in nature and how much I loved plants. And as a high schooler, I had no idea that there was such a thing that you could study plant science and ecology. But when I got to University of Delaware, I started studying plants and geography, and that became my major. And in the beginning of my career in plants, when I first graduated from the university, I did landscape design for a while, horticulture. But the more time I spent in the wild woodlands, I realized that was so much more beautiful than anything I could design. And that's when I started learning more about the wild plants and learning to how to identify all of them, and rare plant species especially. And then I studied more environmental science and more ecology, and here I am.
Here you are.
It's been plants all the time. Lots of different studies along the way. From I was studying pollination biology for a while. I just saw a bumblebee in here a minute ago. And now I've taken it in a different direction with my writing. I started writing about what these places mean to try to get other people to understand. And so my first book was really inspired by this forest and what I wanted to communicate about its importance. And that book was called Teaching the Trees. And then my newest book is about old forests in the East and the old growth forests. Because for the first book, I visited an old growth forest in Maryland near Wye Mills, and so many people wanted to know where that forest was and how to get there that I realized that there was a hunger in people to see these older forests. And I thought, why not? I'll give them directions. I'll tell them how to get there. I'll try to interpret them for them.
So they can...
Yeah.
It's one way to ensure their survival.
You got to see for yourself, or feel for yourself,
right.
Put it that way. Because even if you're blind, I think if you step into a, older forest, you can tell the difference.
You hear them talking. You're listening to On Del Marva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll be right back with more from Joan Maloof. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Welcome back to On Del Mar, and let's get back to the public forest in Quantico, Maryland, where we met up with forest ecologist Joan Maloof. It's hard sometimes maybe to understand the importance from your perspective of these natural forests when people make their living on the forest. And finding that balance is always the trick.
Yes, and it's very tricky because the people that go into forestry work are and logging are the people that love the forest like I do. And so in their case, they might love the forest and say, I'm going to study forests in school, but they'll go to forestry school. And when you're in forestry school, a lot of what you learn is how to manage that for a product. And so that's naturally going to color what you do in the forest. And even just the loggers, maybe they haven't been to forestry school, but it's been in their family for generations. They like their work being outside every day, working for themselves, being in the forest. And they look at it like, well, it's not their decision to cut the woods. It's the landowner's decision. And they're just doing what the landowner asks them to do. So they're caught in a little bit of a quandary, too. And when I talk to the loggers themselves and I say, well, don't you think there should be any forest left here as natural forest on the shore, left uncut? They agree that there should be, but where? You know, so that they feel like that's not up to them to say, I'm not going to cut this. That's up to the people, the landowners that decide. And there are some private landowners that have made that decision not to have their forests cut. And that's wonderful, But that's private land. It's not land that you and I or our children or their children's children can go on. So
how much of the public forest is logged? Most of it? Small percentage?
You know, I haven't seen those numbers. I would say most of it. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Because if it wasn't, we'd have more old growth forests around here. And when I went looking for them, I didn't find much at all.
How do you define old growth forest? What does that mean? As opposed to the natural forest we're in now?
Well, there are many definitions of old growth forest. You'll find out in my new book, Among the Ancients.
Yes.
I say in there's 98 different definitions of old growth forest. So everybody's got their own definition. But as an ecologist, I think of it as a forest that has been left alone long enough that it's the natural processes have taken over. Like I was saying, the trees will grow old and die naturally in place, and then the next generation comes along and the next generation. And it takes generations, really, to build up the soil and the species that can live there so that it's not human-controlled at all. So that might take 300 years. Other people might say, they might have a stricter definition of old growth and say it's one that's never been disturbed by humans. It's our primary forest, one that when John Smith saw when he arrived.
Is any of that alive?
In some places. There are some small, yes.
We'll discover those next time we walk.
Not in Maryland,
not
I
Maryland,
think.
Not
no.
In Maryland.
No.
So how old is old growth in Maryland then?
Well, the small piece near Wye Mills that I saw, probably 250 years old. And Maryland has its own definition of old growth. That has to be, you know, the largest species or more than half of their maximum age span, and et cetera, et cetera.
So what did John Smith see that we're not seeing now?
First of all, what he saw was 95% of the land here was covered in native forest, but old native forest, old growth native forest, true old growth, with much larger stem diameters than we're seeing here. And really more open understory, probably because of the shade from those big old trees. It's a little bit controversial there. Was the understory cleared because of fire, or was it cleared because of the shade of the trees? But it was bigger trees, clear underneath, and the water that he saw was much clearer, right? Why? Because of the forests that were here. One of the reasons.
Right.
But when we walk across that farm field that we just came through, that would not have been a field. That would have been a forest. So not very many forests except the ones that the Native Americans made. I mean, they were farming then, but much smaller patches that were from cleared forest areas. So.
Right.
So our native landscape here is forest.
It's forest. But what you were saying earlier, just the conversation between all those people who love the forest, whether they make their living from the forest or make their world saving the natural forests. That to me is an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah.
Because they both love being outside.
Yes. Yeah.
And respect what they see.
Right. And, you know, we're humans. We need to keep a roof over our heads, and we need to keep food on our tables, and we need to do some sort of work. And the wood from trees is a very useful product for us. You know, I use paper. I would never say stop logging all the trees in Maryland. I think it's a great industry. My dream, you know, if I could be the ruler of the world, would be that some forests would be left untouched, and ideally they would be the public forests that we could get to and enjoy and experience the diversity. And other forests would be logged, but maybe not in the way that we log them now with the big equipment where they're just clear cut and then sprayed with herbicides and often even fertilized, which is not good for the bay. I would love to see a smaller scale logging, where selective logging, where you really study the forest and make a choice tree by tree, what can come out, and still maintain the natural ecosystem. We're a long way from that.
We're a long way from that.
Yeah. I like to look down and see what the forest has shed today. And do you notice all these little things we're seeing on the ground today? They almost look like little brownish worms.
Yes, right.
You know what they are?
No, what are they?
These are the male cones from the loblolly pine tree. And remember all that yellow pollen you got all over your car about a week ago,
yes.
2 weeks ago? Most of it was from these little male pine cones. They would be filled with yellow pollen, and that yellow pollen was shed in the air so that the air could carry it to the little tiny female pine cones. They're so small you can hardly see them at this stage because pollinators don't carry the pine pollen, the air does. And that's why the pine has to make so much of it. So the yellow pollen all got released, and the cones weren't needed any longer. So the next thing that happened was that these cones fell to the ground. So when you see these little things on the ground, it means the worst of that yellow stuff is over, and you can go ahead and set up your porch now. That's what it tells me. Now, the students, last week it was fun because I was teaching a class and it was such a beautiful day and they all wanted to go outside. And I said, here's what we'll do. We'll go outside. We're going to collect some of that yellow pollen off of the cars. We're going to put it under the microscope. We're going to identify what type it is. Because I always had the suspicion that it was mostly pine pollen, but I hadn't really quantified it. So we made slides, put under the microscope, counted pollen grains, and found out that about 90% of the pollen on the cars was pine pollen. And pine pollen doesn't give people allergy problems so much. It's a heavy pollen. It's not the one. So people see the yellow all over their cars and they're having allergy problems and they think that that's it. But it's not. It's the smaller pollen that's still flying around in the air that's bothering them. Not what you see on your cars. And then falling on the ground here is a different sort of oak we haven't talked about yet. And this is a southern red oak. It has
native,
one of our most abundant native trees in a natural situation with the points on the ends. Produce acorns, of course, oak tree. In fact, you don't often notice them because they're so small, but these are the little tiny inconspicuous flowers of an oak. And once this gets fertilized, that's what's going to become the acorn.
Wow.
We don't think of oak trees as having flowers, but they do. They're just tiny. If you put that under a magnifying lens, yeah, they would have all those reproductive parts. And the oaks, of course, are a good food source for, well, used to be humans would eat them, but then it was bears and all sorts of birds, wild turkeys. There was a wild turkey in my yard this morning.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah. The passenger pigeons, have you heard the stories about the great flocks of...
That used to exist in the
East Coast, yeah. And they were mostly eating the acorns and the beech nuts, the mast from the native deciduous species that John Smith would have seen. But as those trees were removed, it's really an open question still as to whether those birds became extinct because of hunting pressure or because of the change in our forests. Because they couldn't survive from just
the
pine trees.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a young black gum tree here. Not very exciting, with its with its just oval leaves with a little point at the end. It's easiest to identify black gum trees in the fall because they're the very first ones to get any fall color. When you see that first little bit of dark red in the forest and you go, oh, it's coming, the winter's coming again, that's the black gum trees that tell us that. But they do make berries that are good food for wildlife, and they do their part.
Not much for us, but for the animals, our other animals.
Right. Yeah, and they're another species that when the forest is converted to primarily pine or pine plantation, that's another one that gets left behind, left out. But that little tree that we saw right there that might just be only a few inches around, that tree could easily live to be 400 years old. And
really?
That the gum very tree. Spot, that gum tree, if it's not disturbed.
Oh.
It's like humans, though. I mean, it could die next year. You know, it could be genetically weak, it could be attacked by insects, or it could live to be 400 years old. There's no way to predict now.
So the pine forests we see natural anywhere on the eastern seaboard in the south, are they all planted?
Well, when you say in the south, that's kind of broad for an ecologist. There are places that are naturally almost 100% pine, like some of the longleaf pine forests down in Georgia and Florida. Also, in areas that are really exposed to a lot of disturbance along some of the waterways, they might be just naturally pure pine stands. But all of these inland forests here would not be...
Are not too deciduous.
Yeah, they would be naturally mixed.
Right.
Pine, oak, hickory. And then, depending on the exact spot you're standing in the soil and the drainage, other species too. So this is a... this is an understory tree. It's called... The common name is shadbush or shadblow. Serviceberry is another common name. It got that name shadblow because it blooms with white flowers just at the time that the shad are coming back up the rivers.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And
that's very interesting.
So
you see this bloom, you know it's time to go find the shad.
Exactly. Yeah. It blooms very early. It blooms in March, April.
We don't have many shad left.
Yeah. But this is a native... understory species. This will never get to be a huge tree, but...
Understory.
Which means not in the canopy. The canopy is the tallest of the trees in the forest, but then some light, as we see today, gets through.
Right.
And so the way nature works, nothing goes to waste. Nature will have evolved, created, whatever words you want to use, other species that can... grow lower to capture whatever light comes through. And the shadblow is one of them. And also it's another thing that gets lost in the conversion to pine plantation because those forests are logged about every 40 years. And so the understory at that point has barely had a chance to start developing before it's taken down again. So... it's one of the beautiful components of an older native forest.
Interesting. I never heard of that tree before this.
This is a white oak. And see how the scallops on the edge of the leaves are rounder than that red oak that we were looking at before?
Mm-hmm.
And the bark... is a little bit more whitish than some of the other barks in here. I think that's how it got its name, white oak. And the oak wood can be very valuable, but not on the shore. It's interesting how that's happened. It's like here we grow pines so fast, and the pines have the most value, and the oaks just get cut and left behind because we really don't have a good market for them here because our oak, they're so much smaller and, I don't know, just market forces at work.
Right.
Loggers wanted to get their hands on this forest 20 years ago. The man that owned this before it became county property said to me that he'd been contacted. They actually ride around. They look for older forests. They find out who the landowners are and contact them and say, your forest should be logged now or the trees could die and then it won't be worth anything. And luckily, at that point, although they offered him tens of thousands of dollars, he decided not to have it be logged because he didn't need the money immediately. And he was, I think, a good person. And then, so because he said no, it still stands. And then when it became county property and they wanted to log it, we made some noise, as I explained to you, and it didn't get logged. So it still stands. But, you know, every year you have to fight these battles over and over again.
Does the county make a lot of money on these forests when they're logged?
The county doesn't own that many forests. So I don't, but yes, they would make a lot of money, but what they would do with the money in this case is use it to develop the park. And developing the park could be a marina or parking lots or ball fields, which some people might think would be a valuable addition to the county. I personally think a native older forest is a better addition for the county.
Right.
So, but it's difficult when the people that are making those decisions aren't naturally the ones that would ever come out and enjoy a place like this. It's hard to make a decision. When you make a decision sitting at your desk, you're going to come to a whole different answer than you will when you make the decision standing out here in the forest.
Right. You're listening to our interview with forest ecologist Joan Maloof. And after she showed us through a native forest on public land in Quantico, Maryland, she took us right down the road to a commercial pine plantation.
We're on the borderline
here. Yeah. So we're just at the property line here between the county property and private property. And if you came here 20 years ago, it would seem like a giant seamless forest where the trees were a little bit bigger on this side, just a little bit, but the same species. And in 1999, they came in here and did a complete clear cut of this forest. And we can see now, 12 years later, the trees are more than twice as tall as I am, but they're very close together, almost all loblolly pine. I would say 90%, 95% loblolly pine in here. And a few little sweet gum and red maple trying to come up underneath. As I said, they're considered weeds. And if they got too aggressive, those species, you might have a plane with herbicide come in and
just
spray them.
Out,
yeah.
Else.
Now, and if you look at the understory here, I don't see any of those ferns we saw. I don't see any of the orchids that we saw. There's none of those understory trees, the dogwood, the amelanch here. There's no beech. So all of those species that depended on those things are all gone. Now these trees right here, they're really too close even for their own good, even if you're just trying to grow pine. So what will probably happen next is they'll come in here and do a thinning. So they'll remove bands of the loblolly pine so that the others grow even faster. So if you've ever flown into or out of this area and you're looking out the window from the plane, you see all these pine forests with these stripes through them.
Right.
And that's what's going on there. It's the thinning. And then these trees will go another maybe 20 years after that thinning, and then there'll be a new contract for another clear cut, and it'll start all over again. So this is going to be a crop now. It used to be a mixed native forest. Now it's going to be a crop. This will go to primarily make cardboard boxes.
Cardboard boxes.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, you know, a crop is a crop. Maybe we need some crops. You know, across the street we have crops of corn and soybeans, but not all our forests should be crops.
Right.
Which do you find more beautiful, this forest or the one we were in earlier?
I'll say two things. The other forest. Just because of its openness and all the things you see in it. But when you're standing in it, you might not know
that
this is not a natural phenomenon.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because you're in the woods and you're surrounded by pine. And
yeah, it's not horrible, but you have to
understand
what's going on. So this question of aesthetics is one that I got interested in just in the last few years. Because when I visited those old growth forests, I was open to what I would discover. You know, as a biologist, I thought, oh, I'll make some great observation and it'll link it all in together. I'll become, you know, the famous old growth scientist. And what I discovered was how beautiful they are. They're just so beautiful. So I started thinking about that. What is this about the beauty in the older forests? So I actually did an experiment where I brought, how many students were there? It was over 200 students out to a forest, brought them to one that looked almost exactly like this, and brought them to a mixed native forest about the same age as the other one we just saw. And had a checklist for them to fill in, and they were just supposed to put a mark on the line of how beautiful they thought the forest was. That was it. Just how beautiful do you think this forest is? How beautiful do you think that forest was? And just like you, they thought the older forest was more beautiful. So the older forests have aesthetic value that we as a culture really haven't learned to put into any of our calculations. Our economic calculations, you know, our decisions for public land, very much.
Right. So. The aesthetic has no, doesn't have a monetary value. It's not a material value.
Right. Or that we haven't put one on it yet.
Right. We haven't put
one. Right. Yeah. We're just starting to learn to do that for other things like pollination and air and water. They call it ecosystem services. We're just beginning to put some economic value on it, but with the aesthetics, it's in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look ahead, I also think that's another thing that I think is going to change. I think hundreds of years from now, we may value the beautiful in nature more than we do now, and it may be the beauty in nature that is what's going to save nature in the long run.
Or we have generations that can grow up thinking this is the forest.
Yeah, and I've had students that have said that. They had no idea. They said, I thought that, you know, those pine forests that I go by, that that's as big as they ever got, and that's what they'd always look like.
Right.
They thought that's what it was.
You've been listening to our conversation with Joan Maloof, forest ecologist and author of the book Among the Ancients, Adventures in the Eastern Old Growth Forests. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.